A short flight of stairs brought them down into a low-ceilinged anteroom. Another photoelectric sensor registered their presence, fed the signal to the portal, and the square of concrete overhead rolled back into place. Kane tensed, waiting for a brief wave of claustrophobia to pass. Bridget eyed the door at the far end of the room. It was of simple, innocuous wood. A push button was screwed into the frame with a small plastic sign above it.
Ring for attendant, should we?
I hope you're joking.
I am. I don't think the people, or whatever, who took over this place still observe the pre-dark security procedures.
Let's go, then.
The door opened easily at the turn of the knob. They gazed down a tile-floored corridor, lined on either side by machines shrouded in plastic dust covers. Some were very large and bulky. As they walked between them, Bridget was able to identify much of the equipment. Fluoroscope, an oscilloscope, centrifuge, evaporator, distillation tanks, and a chromatograph.
Old medical machines. Must have been moved down here when the facility was reactivated. Guess there wasn't much use for them anymore.
Speaking of reactivating, we've got 1 hour and 7 minutes left. I'll track the time.
King gave him an okay sign, then grimaced. The tart scent of chemicals was very strong, almost cloying, but they smelled and could almost taste a worse odor, the taint of death. A set of sheet metal double doors divided the corridor. Kane towed aside the one on the right, and Grant pushed open the left. Another corridor lay beyond, very long and nearly 20 feet wide. The ceiling was still low, lit by an arrangement of red bulbs, though the wattage seemed higher. The walls were composed of sheets of glass, all canted at 45-degree angles. The chromium frames glinted dully in the muted illumination.
What's with this red light? You could go blind in here.
Kane didn't offer a reply, though one part of his mind pounced on the most likely answer. The eyes of Balaam were huge and black, and therefore extremely sensitive to light levels above a certain brightness and spectrum. If this level of the Dulce complex housed Balaam's brethren or his spawn, then it would have been converted for their comfort. Bridget stepped forward. Kane reached for her, but she was too quick. She walked only a dozen feet before halting suddenly in front of a glass wall. Kane nearly trod on her heels.
Where are you?
What Kane saw on the other side of the glass barrier stopped him cold. Spread-eagled on a metal framework was a flayed corpse. It was a mass of yellow-white adipose tissue, ropey blood vessels, and red-blue entrails. The body was all muscle, tendon, and ligament, but the soft organs were pulsing wetly. It was covered, held together by a clinging sack of transparent plastic. Kane felt his belly turn. Grant stepped up beside him. Both of them stared in horrid fascination at the face, at the stripped head covered with a pattern of black-blue veins. Then an eye opened and stared back at them. It was a brown eye, and it held no particular expression. Grant stumbled back a few paces, Sin-Eater coming up reflexively.
It's still alive! Kill it!
No! We'll be discovered!
Forget it. We're running out of time. Come on.
They walked along, and the sights they saw inside the glass-fronted cubicles didn't become any less nauseating. Perhaps the clinical atmosphere and the red lights contributed a sense of unreality, so even though they were on the edge of it, they didn't panic. But each cubicle held another artifact of horror, each one a challenge to their grip on sanity. They passed glass cases and fluid-filled jars with floating human internal organs. In one cubicle, they saw the naked body of a man. His complexion was ruddy, and his hair hung down his back in three thick strands. Parts of him were missing, but there was enough left of the face that they could see the snake tattoo imprinted across it.
Wreath. At least he's dead. Now we know what happened to the bodies in the Cliff Palace.
Oh, God.
Grant and Kane moved to either side of her. Beyond the glass, hanging from a ceiling rack, was a long row of transparent sacks filled with an amber gel. Small figures, curled in fetal positions, floated within the gelid contents.
An incubation chamber. Artificial wombs filled with synthetic amniotic fluid. This is where the hybrids are grown.
Kane stared hard at the creatures inside the wombs. He could see the vestigial noses and the small, thin mouths, almost reptilian in their neatness of tight lips and compressed cheeks.
That's why the bodies of the dregs were left behind. They were genetically ruined. Wreath wasn't aware of the use his merchandise was being put to here, so he tried to slip in damaged goods. Salvo chilled him for it.
Kane felt the repulsion and snarling animal fear rise within him. The hybrids were alien, more alien than human. Arrogance lay in their peaceful faces and relaxed bodies, which were bent almost in attitudes of prayer. They represented the future of the Earth. He whirled and walked away, feeling as though he were swimming through a tidal wave of fear. After a moment, Grant and Bridget fell into step behind him. A few paces past the nursery, they reached the crypt, or at least that was the first word that popped into Kane's mind upon seeing it. Behind frost-streaked glass, naked men and women of all races were entombed, frozen in time. There were dozens of them. They stood in orderly rows, each one upright inside a transparent cryonic tube, arms crossed sedately over their chests. Their bodies had the appearance of pale blue ice, not only in color but composition. Their eyes were closed, and they seemed to be slumbering.
Cold storage. Probably where the best of the best are kept.
What do you mean?
What Lakesh said. Purity control. The purest bloodlines, the highest sperm counts, the most perfect ova. Everything to be cloned and spliced.
Are they dead or just preserved?
I don't know. It doesn't matter to them anymore.
Kane scanned the bodies dispassionately, started to turn away, then focused his vision on the body of one man. He had seen that face before, though it was now carved in ice and relaxed in a forever sleep. He was looking at his father. The realization entered Kane's soul. It clawed at his heart. It sent tentacles of torment into his brain. His spirit was shriveling, all conscious thought blotted out. Shock held him rigid. He opened his mouth, but at first nothing came out.
Dad? You say something?
Kane shook his head and walked blindly past his companions. His numb shock slowly gave way to a deep, visceral ache. He tried to collect his thoughts as he walked. He sought frantically for an anchor. A vision of his father, his mother, and himself as a child hovered in his dimming mind. He began to run, eyes burning with tears. He had wondered just last night if a magistrate could weep. Now he knew. A glass-fronted, metal-framed double door loomed ahead of him. It was the only way out of the area, and it was locked. He kicked it open and lurched through it. Sweat crawled between his armor and his skin. He found himself in a maze of cool white corridors. Static dust collector screens and ventilator ducts were everywhere. Small bore pipelines ran along the right wall, and he followed them, knowing they had to lead to a pumping station and a way back to the surface. He kept running, not able to differentiate between the sound of his own rapid footfalls or those of Bridget and Grant racing behind him.
Kane! Go back. Don't follow me. Kane, use your head. We're short on time and you're short on brains. Stop and think. You don't know what's down there.
Kane slowed down, but only because he was winded. There was nothing ahead of him he could possibly dread more than what lay behind. He stopped in an alcove where cold, vinegary-smelling air dried the sweat on his face. The corridor terminated a few feet away at a door made of heavy-gauge wire mesh. A vague brightness lay beyond it. Kane crouched there, ready to kill or to die, or both. Then he saw shadows flitting past the mesh. He tensed at first, but willed himself to relax, then walked to the door. Kane was standing with his face pressed up against the wire screen, peering through the gaps, when Grant and Bridget joined him. They turned to him, ready to ask the meaning of his actions. Kane turned and savagely gestured them into silence. Then he calmly kicked the door open. Still following the pipes, he walked into a high-ceilinged chamber, or series of chambers, separated by partitions. Ahead of him, he saw a cylindrical filter tank about 20 feet high. Its white surface glistened with moisture, beaded with condensation. Four of the pipes fed directly into steel-collared sockets at its base, and the other four bent away at a 90-degree angle. He moved silently around the curving wall of the tank. Slowly, he eased his head around the cylinder for a view. He saw three men in gray bodysuits, and he recognized them from the night of his initiation into the Trust. The small man with the beginnings of a paunch was named Gwende. The balding Asian was Ojaka. The tall one with the weather-beaten face and gray crew cut was Abrams. They were members of Baron Cobalt's inner circle. They stood in a semicircle around a man whose excessively slender figure was draped in a golden robe. He wore a tall, crested headdress that exaggerated the elongated contours of his skull. His pale golden skin was stretched tight over facial bones that seemed all brow, cheeks, and chin. The eyes were large, slanted, and a yellowish brown in color. Baron Cobalt. And the Baron faced a man that could have been his exact duplicate except for his bright blue eyes and shorter stature. He wore a tight-fitting silvery-gray bodysuit that seemed of a metallic weave. Kane spotted the plastic tubular holster strapped to his upper thigh. Both men moved with a swaying motion, like reeds before a breeze. The movements were very precise, very ritualistic, and Kane knew it was a form of ceremonial greeting.
I regret not locating the document in question, Lord Baron, but I was interrupted by an intruder.
An intruder?
Yes, though I caught only a glimpse, I believe he was in the attire of one of your magistrates.
I was not informed of this by my subordinates. Abrams, what do you know of this?
Nothing, Lord Baron. Salvo is the officer in charge, though at last report he is still incapacitated.
When we return to the Ville, I want him brought before me, on a stretcher if necessary.
One more of their group bustled into view, wearing a suit of baggy coveralls.
We are behind schedule, Lord Baron. Your bath loses its potency.
Matters of my office must be addressed.
The female swayed to and fro in agitation.
Not here. The Directorate is very exact on these matters. 9 days to bathe 9 barons. The schedule cannot be adjusted for one without adjusting it for all.
I regret the delay. However, inasmuch as I serve the Directorate and you serve me, not only am I aware of my responsibilities, but you are dangerously close to exceeding yours.
The female stepped back. Baron Cobalt and his staff followed her out of the range of Kane's vision. Bridget tapped his shoulder from behind.
What's going on?
Get back to the gateway.
He leaned forward. Her hand landed on his arm, but Kane shook free and turned to face her.
Damn it! I said get back to the gateway.
No! The way you're acting, you're going to get us all chilled.
Not if you and Grant do as I say.
We came here together, we leave the same way.
Kane knew that there was no time and no point in arguing.
The Baron is here. Lockish probably knew he would be, and he probably knew we'd encounter him, or he hoped we would.
Encounter him and do what? Chill him?
Or to learn the final bit of truth. It's personal now, between him and me. You two stay here. Grant, when you hear me talking, depending on what I say, I want you to either get the hell out or come to me. Agreed?
Neither Bridget nor Grant made a sound or a move. Kane shook his head in frustration, then circled the filtration tank. He found a maintenance ladder and scaled it quickly. Standing on the rounded top, he stretched up both arms, hooking his hands around a bound collection of pipes, and he chinned himself up onto them. By sheer force of will, he managed to squirm his armored body into the small space between the pipes and the ceiling. He belly-crawled forward, feeling the pipe beneath him quiver with the strain of supporting his weight. He didn't think about what might happen if the ceiling struts tore loose from their moorings and dumped down on the floor. Habit and training took over now. His magistrate consciousness was at work, and it drove away his fears, his anxieties, and his horrors. He pulled himself forward by his arms, worming his body along as fast as he could, as fast as he dared.
Your bath is prepared, Lord Baron.
Kane stopped his forward progress, peering down between a pair of pipes. He had seen pictures of ancient Egyptian sarcophagi. The object, propped up against a crossbarred brace contrivance, looked very similar, like a coffin following the body contours, only this one was molded from some transparent polymer. A pair of flexible hoses was connected to it at opposing midway points. The hoses, in turn, were connected to a metal tank with two valve wheels projecting from the top. Though Kane was above the Baron and his party, their backs were turned to him. Kane could only see the face of the female creature. Abrams removed the Baron's tall headpiece, and Gwende and Ojaka helped him step out of his robe. Naked, Baron Cobalt backed into the transparent sarcophagus, and the little attendant swung the lid over and latched it, sealing it tight. She stepped over to the tank, turned a valve wheel, and a thin, whitish fluid, like milk diluted with water, spurted from the nozzle of one hose. She twisted the second wheel. From the opposite hose spurted a thick red fluid. It dripped down the inner surface of the container, blending with the white liquid and becoming a brown-hued mixture. The sarcophagus filled quickly. The liquid level rose above the Baron's knees, lapped at his thighs, and crept up above his waist. His head was tilted slightly back and up, his large eyes closed, and he breathed deeply and regularly through his open mouth. When the fluid touched the base of his neck, the attendants turned the wheel valve simultaneously, cutting off the twin liquid flows.
I will return in 10 minutes to add the next compound. Remain here with the Baron.
She moved away with a peculiarly graceful, mincing gait. Gwende, Abrams, and Ojaka huddled together, speaking so discreetly Kane couldn't hear them. Fingers curled tightly around a pipe, Kane twisted himself until he hung from his hands almost above their heads. They were so intent on their conference, they didn't notice the pair of black legs dangling only a few feet behind and 12 or so feet above them. Kane released his grip and dropped, bending his knees slightly to cushion his fall. At the noise of his landing, all of them turned in unison, their expressions of astonishment so similar that they could have been triplets. Abrams was the biggest of the three, the most physically capable despite his advanced years. Kane took him on first. Abrams made gestures of negation, as if waving his arms would drive his attacker back. Kane quickly stepped inside the man's outflung arms and kicked his right kneecap.
No! Ah!
Abrams went down on the floor, plucking at his maimed leg. He gaped up at Kane in incredulous horror. Kane planted the steel-reinforced toe of his boot against the point of Abrams' chin, snapping his head back and down. His skull struck the concrete. Kane pivoted on one heel and drove a roundhouse kick into Ojaka's lower belly. The man folded over Kane's leg, and while he was suspended there, Kane brought his left fist in a snapping arc against the bridge of Ojaka's nose. Gwende was paralyzed, merely staring. He gaped at Kane and didn't move. Kane's right leg arced upward and around in a spinning crescent kick. The sole of his boot caught Gwende on the left side of his head. Consciousness went out of his eyes with the suddenness of a candle being extinguished. He made no movement afterward. All three men lay helpless, and Kane walked over to the sarcophagus. The Baron hadn't been aware of the brief struggle. He was still luxuriating in his bath, eyes closed as if in serene meditation. Kane rapped on the transparent cover. Baron Cobalt's eyelids twitched. The eyelids fluttered, then lifted. The annoyance in them changed instantly when they took in the black helmet, the red visor, and the cold, bear-toothed grin beneath it. The Baron's body convulsed, sloshing the fluid around, splashing it up onto his face. Kane flipped open the latches and heaved the lid aside. Kane smelled peroxide, alcohol, and the faint coppery stink of diluted blood. The sudden release of pent-up pressures washed the Baron out. His feet scrabbled on the slick floor, trying to gain some sort of purchase. Then he went down heavily. Setting his feet firmly as the liquid swirled around them, Kane bent down, closed his left hand around the short, delicate column of Baron Cobalt's neck, and hauled him upright. Kane swung him around, slamming his back against the filtration tank, pinning him there with his hand around his throat. He raised the Sin Eater until its bore was on a direct line to a spot between the Baron's eyes. His struggles ceased. Despite the residue of the noxious fluid still clinging to his body, Kane saw the Baron was completely hairless. Even his pubic area was smooth. His sex organ was a tiny bud, no larger or thicker than the tip of Kane's little finger.
So, Kane, traitor, criminal, murderer, you will surrender yourself to me and confess your crimes.
That doesn't work anymore, Baron. You're not a god king. You're not divine. You're not even a good employer. You're a laboratory monstrosity with an attitude. A vampire living off the genetic material of human beings. You have to take baths in chemicals and gore. You're disgusting, is what you are.
How dare you presume to pass judgment, you filthy apeling! Are you truly so deluded that you believe you can defy the baronies and the directorate?
You're a puppet whose strings are pulled by a bunch of little gray bastards, and you think I'm deluded?
Kane relaxed the grip around the Baron's throat ever so slightly.
You think the Archons are responsible for what happened to the world? We did it to ourselves.
We? Don't put yourself on the same footing as humans.
I stand corrected. I occupy a much higher position. Yes, I am a hybrid of human and Archon, and I am ashamed of the human element within me. I take a bit of solace in the fact that at least my human genes spring from the very best, carefully selected stock.
In anticipation of the Baron's next words, Kane's limbs began to tremble. Baron Cobalt noticed, and his smile widened.
You face an interesting problem. Much of that superior genetic human material derives from your father. If you kill me, you'll be committing fratricide after a fashion. A sin that, I recall from my old religious teachings, immediately consigned souls to eternal damnation. Do you want to be damned?
Kane gritted his teeth, battling the soul-destroying sickness threatening to overwhelm him.
Why are you here, Kane?
To find the truth about you, about humanity. I had to find out if you and your kind actually existed, or if you were some strain of mutant.
I am human, Kane. The new human.
Kane studied Baron Cobalt's face, the golden eyes, bright with intelligence, the too smooth skin, the high forehead, the small ears set low on the head.
No. You're outside of humanity.
The humanity you know is dead. The new humanity is taking its place. All a matter of natural selection. Nature taking its course.
Nature didn't create you.
Sometimes nature must be prodded. Believe me, Kane, I sympathize with your shock, your disorientation. You would have been indoctrinated eventually into these secrets. Why, not even Salvo has been to this part of the installation. Return with me to the Ville, and you will take his place in the Trust. You will occupy an exalted position. You will not be serving me or the Archon Directorate, but the new humanity. We are a highly evolved breed, and our numbers are growing. We find rewards in life that our forebears were incapable of appreciating. This is our world now, and nothing can be done to arrest the tide. Stop opposing us. It will do you no good. Accept our kind, as we have accepted your kind.
My father and all those others did not volunteer to serve or to help create a new humanity. You enslaved them, stole their lives and their identities. No matter how highly evolved you claim your breed is, you still need lowly humans to survive. You need lousy humans like Reef to supply you with fresh meat. So explain to me, Lord Baron, how does all that scheming and stealing and double-crossing make you superior to us apelings? You're no different than the lowliest pit boss in the worst slag hole of Tartarus.
Baron Cobalt's hands came up, his long fingers clutching at Kane's wrist, trying to tear his hand away from his throat.
You'll die! I'll have you dismembered while you're still alive!
Kane tightened his hold on the Baron's throat.
Look at you. You're puny. Your body is fragile. You have to be sustained by artificial means. You and the Archons are so terrified of us, you trick us into living down to our basest impulses, then condition us to be ashamed of the very positions you forced us into. No, you're not superior. What you are is a race of jealous, dickless cowards.
The fury in the golden eyes burned hot and molten. The Baron struggled wildly, kicking at Kane's legs, long fingers flailing at his face. He fought like a trapped animal, crushing his knuckles on Kane's armored chest, mashing toes into his shin guards. Kane held onto him easily.
Arrest my case, Lord Baron. You can't beat us. You may have won a battle. You may have won a lot of battles throughout history. But this is a war that's been waged for thousands of years, and humanity always manages to get back up one more time after the Archons have knocked us down. No matter how blasphemous it sounds to you, we'll get up again, and we'll kick your genetically superior asses out of our lives and our futures once and for all.
To emphasize his words, Kane slowly squeezed the Baron's throat even tighter. His wind cut off, Baron Cobalt's face grew dark with congested blood. His pale tongue protruded past his thin lips. Kane maintained the pressure until the Baron's slim frame shuddered and sagged. Kane opened his hand, and the Baron dropped limply to the floor on his right side. Kane gazed down at him, not sure if he'd choked the life out of him or not, and not giving a damn one way or the other.
New humanity, my ass.
Kane spoke into the helmet comlink.
Grant?
Right here.
You heard?
Your side of it.
Where are you?
Where you left us.
Stay there.
A pulse of sound drove into Kane's head, penetrating his helmet and eardrums like a white-hot nail. He reeled in a sudden blaze of pain, his scuffling feet unsteady and seeking purchase in the puddle around him. The sound was almost physical, tightening around his brain like a steel vise. He managed to keep from falling, shambling around in a half turn to see a quartet of hybrids approaching. The one occupying a center position wore the gray metallic suit, and he held a slender silver wand in his right hand. The wand was about 3 feet long, and it hummed and shivered, its gleaming length somehow blurred.
I've seen him before in the Cliff Palace.
Subdue him or kill him.
Kane raised his blaster. The tip of the wand dipped toward him. Kane collapsed, hammered to the floor by the storm of pain. He caught himself on his elbows, steadying the Sin Eater in a double-handed grip. His first target was the man with the wand. He worked the trigger. The gleaming rod swept out, fanning in a hazy semicircle. The slender man stood unharmed and smiling. Again, the wand inscribed an arc, its tip dancing from left to right. Somehow, the rod produced an invisible field that deflected the bullets, yet at the same time could direct energies that made Kane's head feel as if it were about to burst. He couldn't understand the dynamic at work, and he doubted his questions would be answered if he asked them. He shifted the barrel of the Sin Eater a fraction to the right and squeezed the trigger. The little hybrid standing beside the man with the wand catapulted backward, his torso squirting out blood like a squeezed sponge. The creatures on either side of him reacted by trying to run blindly away without even attempting to watch where they were going. Kane fired again. The heavy caliber round took another hybrid in the chest and spun him around in a grotesque pirouette. Banners of blood streamed from the wound, draping his companions and the walls with red liquid ribbons. The man holding the wand stumbled aside, his face crimson bedaubed, trying to clear his vision with frantic swipes from his left hand. Kane gathered his legs beneath him, sprang to his feet, and began a dizzy, shambling run. He tasted blood sliding warmly over his lips, streaming from ruptured capillaries in his nose. He had no idea what kind of weapon the hybrid employed, but he was fairly certain his helmet had saved him from exploded eardrums or worse. The floor pitched and yawed beneath him, and he had trouble running in a straight line. He fixed his gaze on the top of the filtration tank as a landmark, and he raced toward it. Pale figures flitted near him on either side of the red-tinged gloom, lithe and swift, seeking to draw ahead and cut off his escape. He reached the base of the tank and ran around it. Kane saw Bridget coming toward him, holding her H&K in a double grip, backed by Grant sweeping the perimeter with his Sin Eater. A faint twist of smoke curled from the barrel. Kane tried to stop, but he skidded and stumbled and would have fallen if Grant hadn't steadied him. He wiped blood from his mouth with the back of his hand.
They're onto us now. They've got some kind of weapon. I don't know what it is, but it's pretty nasty. They almost got me.
Yeah, they were trying to outflank you. Guess they thought you were alone, because they sure as hell didn't expect to see us. Those little fuckers are light on their feet.
The air suddenly shivered with a hum, and Kane jerked reflexively. The surface of the tank near his head suddenly acquired a deep dent. Wiry slivers of metal and scraps of paint burst up all around the impact point. The three of them started to run.
Ultrasonics, infrasound, electric current converted to sonic waves by a little gadget called a maser.
Bridget saw how Kane swayed unsteadily on his feet and had to clutch at the pipelines on the wall for support.
You took a hit?
Yeah, maybe more than one.
If it's any consolation, all you probably suffered was a little inner ear damage. Nothing permanent.
The three of them reached the wire mesh door and plunged into the corridor. Grant stopped to look behind, digging into his war bag.
Keep going!
He held the DM5 frag gren in his left hand, pulled away the pin with his teeth, and tossed it underhanded. It landed where the wall joined with the floor, directly beneath the pipelines. He turned and sprinted down the corridor. The steel balls punctured the pipes, and clouds of steam mixed with the billowing smoke. Even through his armor, Grant felt the puff of heat. He caught up with Kane and Bridget.
Don't know if that slowed him up any.
Let's assume it didn't.
The foul-smelling vapor drifted toward them, and they jogged away from it. As they approached the glass door leading to the alley, they slowed to a trot. Kane didn't want to walk through it again unless the circumstances were dire. Grant fell forward, back arched, arms outstretched as if he had received a blow between the shoulder blades. As he toppled, Kane saw the fist-sized dent in his armor. Simultaneously, the door exploded inward with a shower of glass. Bridget's reaction was the fastest. Finger already on the trigger of the H&K, she swiveled from the hips and fired a whole magazine down the steam and smoke-filled corridor. Grant pushed himself to his knees, wagging his head from side to side. Bridget stepped beside him, her eyes probing the mist.
You caught an overspill of the ultrasonics. You'll be okay.
Kane dragged him to his feet and hustled him toward the doorway.
Something's wrong with my eyes. Everything's out of focus.
Yep. We're in wonderful shape. The motion impaired, leading the blind.
Bridget ejected the spent clip from her hand blaster and thumbed in a fresh one.
Get going! I'll cover your backsides.
Kane and Grant kicked through the shattered ruin of the door and entered the alley.
I'm better. Things aren't as blurry.
Releasing him, Kane turned to see Bridget backing through the scattering of broken glass, blaster trained on the corridor.
Don't see them. Maybe the going got too rough.
It's apt to get rougher. They probably have another way topside, and they'll be waiting to cut us off.
He glanced at his cron.
We've got 21 minutes. That's not enough time for all of us to get back to level 4.
It's more than enough time if you stop making gloomy predictions and get moving.
This situation is the classic one percenter.
We'll improve the odds as we go.
They went back into the nightmare lab area. Kane saw no use in ordering a standard deployment of personnel and firepower. He was still suffering from bouts of vertigo and reeling drunkenly from time to time. Grant's vision was still foggy, and Bridget was untrained. So they ran in a blundering rush, Kane occasionally veering from side to side, bumping into Grant, who was feeling his way along the glass-fronted wall. They approached the section where the bodies lay in cryonic stasis.
Wait. Stop.
He reached into his war bag and produced a pair of grenades. He hefted them in either hand.
Incense. How many do you have, Grant?
Grant pawed through his pouch.
One.
What do you want those for?
I want to blow this place.
Why? Diversion, revenge, or what?
A little of all three. Also, mercy. If those people are still alive, at least we can make sure they won't be used as biological material for the new humanity.
It might not do any good, Kane. Their cryonic canisters might be well shielded.
It might not do any good. It might not stop the program. But at least we can screw up the timetable a little.
What difference would it make?
A great deal. To me.
Using his thumbs, Kane flipped away the firing levers, tossed them behind him, and started running.
God damn, Kane!
Grant hurriedly pulled the lever of his gren, hurled it, and ran after him. Bridget outdistanced them both. The glass-fronted cubicles shattered as if giant fists smashed into them. The entire passageway shuddered brutally. Shards of glass rained down on the floor behind them, and the scorching heat of the thermite charges buffeted their bodies. Grant's incendiary detonated, and the rolling balls of flame overlapped, instantly building to a roaring inferno. A hurricane of superheated air converged from all sides, slapping their breaths back into their nostrils. An intolerable white glare lit their way, casting their elongated, distorted shadows on the floor ahead of them. Their eyes, adjusted to the red-tinted dimness of the installation, stung and watered. A cloud of smoke billowed after them, bringing with it a faint scent like overcooked pork. The scent of double doors came in sight. The three people slammed them aside. They rushed down the aisle between the old medical machines and kicked open the adjoining door. Rushing through the anteroom, they stumbled to the foot of the stairs, tripping the photoelectric sensor in the process. Overhead, the concrete slab pivoted up on its side. The three of them scrambled through before it was fully ajar. They ran across the bare floor and empty spaces toward the metal staircase. Kane, his eyes recovering from the glare, was aware of pale, graceful shapes flashing swiftly out of the shadows. But he and his companions reached the stairs and hauled themselves up them without being molested. When they made the walkway, they saw why. The catwalk was blocked by a clot of hybrids. Several of them swished silver wands through the air like fencers warming up for a duel. Bridget took a step back and cast a glance over her shoulder.
Oh, hell!
Clustered around the base of the stairway glittered dozens of eyes. From the group blocking their forward progress, the hybrid Kane recognized stepped forward, the metal rod rocking back and forth in his hand like the needle of a metronome. A smile creased his thin mouth.
It is our practice to subdue and contain intruders. Killing is something of a necessity, but oftentimes useful tissues are damaged. Will you accept the inevitable?
Kane shared a brief look with Grant and Bridget. They gave quick nods, and he turned to face the hybrid. He slid the Sin-Eater back into its holster. Grant followed suit. Kane spread his arms wide, hands held at shoulder level. He approached the group slowly.
We accept your terms.
An expression bordering on disappointment crossed the hybrid's smooth, angular face.
A logical choice for enabling.
Kane stopped a few feet away.
What are your orders?
The deferential note in Kane's voice inspired the hybrid to take a step forward, an arrogant tilt to his head.
First you will disarm and then disrobe.
Kane swung his left arm in a vicious sweep. His forearm took the hybrid across the throat. The hybrid flailed backward over the rail. In falling, he dropped the wand and clutched at one of his comrades, which cost the standing hybrid his balance. He stumbled and fell against those behind him. The Sin Eater slid into Kane's hand and he fired it into the group of hybrids. Behind him, Bridget opened up with the Agent K and Grant roared on the copperhead. Bodies reeled backward in a surge of exploding flesh and bones. Then a giant's blow struck Kane's right arm and he felt the wrist bone break. Kane caught only a jagged afterimage of a vibrating silver wand before he went down on the catwalk. Agony lanced up his arm into his shoulder as he tried to maintain pressure on the trigger. His hand didn't seem to be there anymore. He felt delicately fingered hands clawing him. Some of the fingers had sharp little nails that slashed bloody furrows in his face.
Kane!
Kane drove his right leg forward, and his boot sole collapsed and broke a narrow face bobbing above him. Rather than try to unlimber his copperhead from his belt, he reached down and withdrew his combat knife from its boot sheath. Gripping it in his left hand, he swung the blade down again and again at the bodies remaining before him. He thrust upward as a hybrid tried to bring a wand to bear. The blade parried the humming rod. The knife vibrated violently, stung Kane's fingers, and flew from his hand over the side. He drove his fist square between the big eyes, and he dropped, senseless and bleeding, on top of Kane. Kane reached for the wand, but a hybrid's foot kicked it away. He heaved the doll-like body up, carrying it with him as he sprang to his feet. He flung the limp form into a pair of hybrids, bowling them off their feet. With a cold fury, Kane struck blow after blow with his fist and feet, punching, kicking, stomping. Hybrids stampeded away from him, leaving the bodies of their brethren lying with ribs and limbs broken, scalps split open and leaking. He fumbled with his copperhead, bringing it to bear with his left hand. The burst he fired toward the retreating hybrids was poorly aimed, but the storm of slugs picked up several and hurled them forward, tumbling them limply head over heels.
See? See? You little parasites can die just as easily as us apelings.
Kane turned to see Bridget and Grant, pale bodies and arms hauling at them from all sides. Grant was applying the butt of his copperhead, trying to fend them off. Bridget's blaster was out of ammo, and hands gripped her ankles. She bent to beat them off with the barrel of her H&K, then other hands caught at her and brought her down. More of the hybrids pulled themselves up on the walkway and leaped upon her. Bridget managed to break free, but a long hand clawed for her face. She sank her teeth into it, biting until she felt the delicate bones break. The hybrid snatched his hand away. Kane moved over to her, clearing a path by kicking and stamping. She managed to stagger erect, blood streaming from a dozen nail-inflicted scratches on her arms. More hybrids slithered up onto the catwalk. Here and there gleamed the wands. Taking a firm grip on Bridget's arm, Kane raced along the walkway, followed in close formation by Grant, firing the copperhead ahead of him. The hybrids in their path were driven to the rails, and they slipped over, preferring the 30-foot drop to facing the crazed humans and the narrow confines of the catwalk. The floor plates were slippery with blood and viscera, and Kane booted several corpses out of the way. A group of hybrids danced after them at a discreet distance. When they reached the booth, Grant paused inside of it while Kane and Bridget made their way out into the hallway. From his bag, he took a pair of flares, shut his eyes, and snapped the rods in half. A blinding violet-white light splashed the room with an eerie luminescence. The blaze of light was so intense that even through Grant's visor and closed eyelids, it registered. He tossed them against the hanging decam coveralls, and the old material ignited immediately. Before Grant rushed through the opposite door, flame flashed throughout the booth. He prayed the fire and the near-blinding incandescence of the flares would discourage further pursuit. He rejoined his companions halfway up the ramp. They reached the landing, and fortunately, the bulkhead was still open. They staggered up the other stairwell and, forgetting their earlier caution, clung to and hauled themselves up by the handrails. The door was unlocked as they left it, and they entered the dim corridor on level 4. As Kane checked his cron, he heard the distant whine and hydraulic hiss of an elevator.
On their way by the elevator. Let's hope they don't arrive in the next 2 minutes.
They turned the corner and saw the open door of the control room. Approaching the door from the opposite direction was a group of small, pale figures. The two groups saw each other at the same time. The three of them surged forward in a wild rush. Grant snapped off a couple of shots, aiming into the press of bodies, hoping to knock down his targets and trip up others. The hybrids kept coming. One of the hybrids outpaced the others and waved a silver wand over his head like a saber, racing bravely forward.
No!
Suddenly, with a spurt of speed, Bridget bounded ahead, head back, legs pumping. The pair met in the corridor when they were abreast of the open door. The hybrid slashed down with a wand, its point aiming at her. She left her feet in a long dive, her shoulders catching the smallish hybrid at ankle level, smashing him sideways, bouncing him off the door jamb and sending him careening into the room. She pounced atop him, wrestling with him for the wand. She got the heel of one hand under the hybrid's pointed chin and threw all her weight into a sharp push. The hybrid's grip on the wand weakened. Bridget wrenched it from his hand, turned it, and touched the left side of his head with the tip. His skull collapsed where the point touched. A small, perfectly round hole was punched through the epidermal layers, splintering the bones, liquefying and blowing most of his brains through his tiny right ear. Kane and Grant shouldered their way into the room, sending covering fire down the corridor. Kane back-kicked the door shut behind them, and Grant wrestled a heavy chair across the floor, jamming the back beneath the knob. Bridget got to her feet.
That won't hold against an ultrasound assault. They may even be able to breach the gateway, since it's not made of armaglass.
They've got less than 1 minute to prove it to us.
They got inside the chamber, Grant pulling the heavy steel door closed and spinning the wheel lock. The single overhead light came on. Kane, cradling his broken wrist, sat down. Bridget eased down beside him. Sweat had cut runnels in her combat cosmetics. Grant hunched over beside the door.
Why did you take that chance out there, Baptiste?
She raised the rod to eye level and sighted down its length.
An artifact. A souvenir. It might tell us something about their technology.
Shh. I think they got in.
The door shuddered as it took the terrible impact of focused infrasound. The paint split and blistered and peeled away in long strips. The cross braces vibrated violently, and rivets and bolts loosened. Bits of concrete around the doorframe flaked, showered down, and fell away in chunks.
Come on, Lakesh. You're behind schedule.
The floor and ceiling discs sprang to glowing life. Mist gathered and thickened above and below. Tiny, flashing sparks floated through the air.
Thank God.
Grant sat down, putting his back against the wall, hands resting on his knees.
A one percenter to remember.
As the mist curled down and entwined with the tendrils spiraling upward, Kane closed his eyes and leaned his head back.
Dad. Goodbye.
It was an old road Kane walked, but since it was his first time, it was new to him. He had the impression of following the track of a giant broken-backed snake to and fro. The asphalt was cracked and deeply rutted. The last crimson glory of the setting sun cast red shadows on the snow-covered mountain peaks above him. He breathed the fragrance of the wind that rolled up from the forests far, far below. Though craggy cliffs rose gray and gaunt before and around him, the foothills behind were rich with grassy meadows and green groves of trees. On his right, the road wound and twisted and looped across the sheer face of a cliff, and to his left, a deep abyss plummeted straight down 1,000 feet or more. At one time, steel guardrails had bordered the lip of the road, but only a few rusted metal stanchions remained. Past the edge of the road, at the bottom of the abyss, were the metal skeletons of several vehicles. More than likely, they had lain there since the time of the nuke cost, weathering all the seasons that came after. Now, in late Montana summer, they looked like tombstones. He picked up a rock from the roadbed and tossed it over the abyss, trying, but knowing he couldn't bounce it from one of the metal carcasses. There wasn't the slightest complaint from the area where, just 2 days before, a burst of ultrasound had shattered his wrist. It was still encased by a lightweight cast halfway to his elbow, but none of the nerves had been damaged, and the bones should knit quickly. At least, that was the prognosis of DeFore, the resident medic. He walked carefully, alertly, along the curving road, keeping close to the cliff face. Lakesh had told him that when the Cerberus Redoubt was built, the road had been protected by a force field powered by atomic generators. Sometime during the past century, the energy screen had been permanently deactivated when many survivors were scavenging off the land. Kane went around a pair of bends in the road, and the split tarmac broadened onto a huge plateau. Inside the chain-link fence perimeter was the base of a mountain peak, and nestled against the rock face was a high gate, corrugated metal gleaming beneath peeling paint. It was open now, and Bridget, Grant, Domi, and Lakesh emerged from it. Lakesh was leaning on Domi, as though he had lost his strength, but Kane was pretty certain he simply enjoyed leaning against a shapely young woman. At least Lakesh had given him the whole story when they returned from Dulsa. As Kane had already figured, his father and a former Mag had gone to Dulsa to bring back Balam. Only the Mag and Balam had come back. Kane stopped and admired the sunset. It was difficult not to envision it setting behind the administrative monolith, but the glow around the mountain peaks was certainly more picturesque. The others joined him.
Friend Kane, I had hoped that affairs would take a slower pace after your return. They have not. I've just come back from Cobaltville, and from an emergency meeting of the Trust.
Minus a few, I imagine.
There are always more where Abrams, Sojaka, and Gwende came from. Besides, they're not dead, just discouraged. Unfortunately, the Baron lives as well.
More where he came from, too.
They're looking for us, Kane. In dead earnest, they've convened a council of the Nine Barons.
Kane stepped closer to the edge, kicking a loose stone into the chasm. The wind tugged at his hair, and a smile tugged at the corners of his mouth. He saw the forests below, then raised his gaze to the mountains, the sun, and sky. Beyond that lay the vast web of the universe. He had the feeling that his father was out there, gliding among the stars, watching what he did next, hoping and aspiring, and having faith in his son. He turned and looked at Bridget, letting their eyes meet in a wordless exchange. He liked her strength and flexibility, though at times she irked him with her cool logic. There was something else about her that spoke to a part of him that was hidden, unpracticed, unacknowledged. As if in approval, he nodded at her, then scanned the faces of the others. They were good faces, strong faces, all different, showing age and wisdom, pain and determination, the courage of youth, and a kind of beauty and endurance. Human faces. Exiles from the world of their birth.
Well, so the Council of the Nine are after us. All that means is we have our work cut out for us. Not just to save our skins, but to find the weapons to reclaim our blue planet.
Once again, he turned toward the abyss and stabbed his hand toward the purplish haze of the Outlands.
Like it or not, we're in this together.
Outlander's Exile to Hell is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 1997, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Hazelford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Dolores King-Williams, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Hazelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Chris Rowan, Christian Parent, and Nathan DeBoard. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan, Christian Parent, and Brian Rogers. Adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Chris Rowan, Brian Patton, and Matt Webb. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at roadstops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
The Baronies ruling post-apocalyptic America are no more. Yet even as settlers leave the fortress cities and attempt to build new lives in the untamed outlands, a deadly new struggle is born. Amidst the sacred Indian lands in Wyoming's Bighorn Mountains, the Millennial Consortium, led by Benedict Snow, is engaged in the excavation of ancient artifacts, turning the newly liberated outlands into a hell zone.
Incoming!
Shit! Get down!
Get out from under the wags! Your people are sitting ducks! Retreat!
Kane and the Cerberus Warriors organize a strike against Snow and his band, only to find themselves delving into a world beyond science, where Indian mythology is fact. Here they will come face to face with the fury of a Lakota woman warrior.
My mother fasted for 3 days, then entered the sweat lodge, and went into a trance that lasted 4 days. She opened a channel to the great mystery, but she was also open to other energies. She would not awaken. My father broke with tradition and tried to rouse her.
Had she died?
Worse. She had met a ghost in her journey on the spirit path, and he had stolen her soul. When she opened her eyes, it was not Nightingale Woman who looked at us, but Tawasi, the Owl Prophet. He told us how he had ensnared my mother's soul. If we did not do as he bid, in every way, her soul would remain imprisoned.
What did you do?
What I had to do. I killed my mother.
Driven by power, hatred, and revenge, this warrior known as Catamount will join forces with Benedict Snow, and the two will find themselves on the verge of uncovering a force of unfathomable evil.
We share this body. When he first touched the Time A, we both understood we were kindred in nature. A link was forged. We share each other's knowledge and experiences. Our minds are intertwined. There is no separation any longer.
Outlanders number 35, Cerberus Storm.
Submitted for your consideration. Fulcroft Sanitarium, Rye, New York, 6 a.m. The director arrives for another work day.
Good morning, Mrs. McCulka.
No calls, Dr. Smith.
2 miles away, a crew works on a telephone pole.
Catch anything?
No, Mr. Krogstad, the lines are quiet.
Sever them.
Meanwhile, on nearby Long Island Sound, 3 speedboats bob with the gentle motion of the waves.
Anybody spot our man?
The sun is coming right off the windows. See for yourself.
Screw it. We can't wait all day. The word is go. Repeat, the word is go.
Harold Smith, director of the Fulcroft Sanitarium, thought he was arriving for another normal workday. But Harold Smith, also director of the super-secret government agency known as CURE, is about to enter a realm that makes the Twilight Zone look like a quilting bee.
Dr. Smith, there's a terrible racket going on outside.
I know. Tell the lobby guard to retreat to a safe place. Fulcroft is under attack.
Ceasefire! Ceasefire! We surrender!
Freeze! DEA!
IRS! We're the goddamn IRS!
The evil machinations of the capitalistic supercomputer known as Friend have made Harold Smith seem responsible for $12 million worth of drug money, unreported income, or both. Remo Williams and Chun, the master of Shinunju, the other two elements comprising CURE, come to Smith's aid. But Smith's solution to his problems may be more than either man has bargained for.
Smitty, what's the good word? Or in your case, the bad one.
Greetings, Harold the Resolute.
Remo, you have failed CURE and your country, and you, Master Chun, have failed your emperor. You above all know that once CURE is compromised, certain instructions are inviolate.
There is always time to die, Smith. If that is your wish, it will be carried out.
death, and taxes. Destroyer number 97, Identity Crisis. In a human empire of technological wonders, an old human affliction has reared its ugly head, and the Empire's scientists can do nothing about it but quarantine the afflicted. The jungle planet, Lacrimae Christi, serves this purpose. Mother Superior Beatrice and her beleaguered nuns have taken on the holy mission to minister and bring succor to the poor victims of this dreaded disease.
God is always with us. He just won't fight our battles for us.
It's a brutally difficult task, but it's made hellishly worse when the hated men cyborgs come to claim the planet as their own. The Mother Superior's request for help can only be answered by Owen Deathstalker and his unique squad of fighters.
A Hademan ship just dropped out of hyperspace right next to us. How the hell did they know we were going to be here?
Tell you what, you ask them and I'll concentrate on getting us the hell out of here.
Is it too late to turn this ship around?
When Owen and Hazel's team finally fight their way to the thinly fortified walls of Lacrimae Christi's only city, they are confronted with an overwhelming enemy force of genetically augmented supermen, equipped with special troops of the fiercest alien killing machines ever encountered by man. There's something else to deal with, too. A mysterious life form indigenous to the planet.
It is alive, but it's like nothing else I've ever encountered. It thinks slow thoughts, but it's growing angry. And it knows where we are.
And by the time the dust settles, Owen may have lost forever the one he holds most dear.
Owen! Help me!
Hazel!
Deathstalker Honor, Episode 6, The Red Brain.
Well done, guys. This drug ring is closed. Stryker?
Everything's good out here. I'll see you out, Able Team.
Who's doing this to my operations?
I have heard whispers, Colonel. Groups have told of a stony man.
Bring them to me. I want to see them suffer as we have suffered.
A powerful Soviet hardliner has discovered the identities and plans of the Stony Man Force. With this information, he's ready to execute his plan. A plan that will make him the undisputed ruler of the Russian Mafia. And then, Russia itself.
This is the last of the cash. Are we ready to make a deal?
Die, American scum!
Lyons, I heard shooting. What happened?
Schwartz, Blancanales, we were ambushed. Jesus, Poland, they're dead.
Now, Phoenix Force, with the guidance of Katzenellenbogen, must make a decision that could go against everything they stand for, in the name of revenge.
As of this moment, Stony Man takes orders from no one. Schwartz and Blancanales will be avenged, no matter the cost.
But Schwartz and Blancanales' apparent deaths are all just part of the plan.
Now, Schwartz, you will tell me the location of Stony Man Farm.
Never.
Oh, I'm quite sure you will.
Stony Man number 39, Breach of Trust. Only from Graphic Audio.
In the blood and mayhem of the Deathlands, one rarely gets to relax and enjoy even a single minute, let alone visit paradise.
Welcome to Green Glades, where your every desire can come true.
Oh, what's that, Mildred?
Oh, a roller coaster. I used to love those when I was your age. Looks like fun, doesn't it?
Dad, can I go? Can I ride?
Sure, son. But in the Deathlands, everything comes with a price tag.
There's something I want from you, friend Ryan.
And what's that, Zap?
Your son, Ryan. I want your son.
And now, Ryan faces the decision of his life.
over my dead body, you sick bastard.
That can be arranged.
Deathlands number 14, Dark Carnival.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net.